Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Shorten Associates, legal recruiters in Louisiana and Texas.
From Tula Tacos and Amigos in downtown Lafayette, we're out to lunch with Christian Mader, publisher and editor of The Current. It's business, Acadiana style.
Welcome to Out to Lunch. I'm Christian Mader. What's the difference between an artist and an artisan? You might say one makes things for expression and the other for use. But in reality, the line is pretty blurry. It's a distinction without a difference for the people who are actually making things. Art and craftsmanship have always been in conversation. I'm not an art historian, but it strikes me that creating for expression was made possible by creating for necessity. You know, ancient Mesopotamians discovered glassmaking, Syrians blow it into household goods. Eventually, you get Dale Chihuly. But plenty of artists and artisans flow back and forth across whatever imaginary line human beings need to draw between categories. You know, I once visited our first guest, Francis Pavia, at his studio in Lafayette's Freetown neighborhood, and you could be forgiven for thinking it was a workshop. You know, he's best known as a painter, and Francis has shown his work internationally, but he's also a wonder with a CNC router, and he carves blocks to make his iconic paintings with motifs of Louisiana mythology, pop culture, or icons like Elvis in 20th century design. Now, Francis grew up in Lafayette and began his career in glassmaking, moving quickly into painting in the 1980s, and recently he and his wife, Kathy, a designer, launched an imprint for creating fabrics. Each textile features hand-designed patterns with orders filled on demand, and their line now includes 8 different designs meticulously crafted in a digital processing method Francis created to accommodate his style into fabric. Always pushing the edge with technology, Francis Pavia, welcome to Out to Lunch.
Good morning, Christian and Erica.
You know, since long before there was an Acadiana, this region has been blessed with a vibrant maker culture. The Atakapa Ishak tribe that populated southwestern Louisiana and East Texas were known for their trading posts where travelers and craftsmen could trade their goods. And that's the tradition my guest Erica Fox and her partner Kimberly Abadie Moore tapped into when they launched Atakapa Collective, a cooperative that serves as a retailer and platform for local artisans, especially indigenous people and women of color. Erica and Kimberly saw an opportunity in the time people have spent creating during the pandemic and put the collective together as an outlet. The shop opened in downtown Lafayette in 2021, just around the corner from Pavia Studio, actually, and now represents 34 artisans who produce local goods like tapestries, jewelry, metalworking, and more. Erica is also a songwriter and a Lafayette native. She spent 14 years in L.A. as a commercial artist. She was signed to No Limit Records before moving back to Lafayette. Erica Fox, welcome to Out to Lunch.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Yep. Hey, good to see you. Francis, I don't know that I've spent much of my life in the market for textiles. And, you know, y'all are marketing this stuff on a sort of an on-demand basis. So I'm curious, who in your mind is the target audience for Pavia Textiles? Is it somebody that would already be familiar with your work?
Well, the end user would be the consumer. But, you know, we're targeting designers, particularly architects, and you know, we want to be more wholesalers than retailers. So showrooms, design showrooms, architects, and designers.
Is this a concept? I mean, I feel kind of silly asking this question, that's been around where artists like yourself kind of move into this sort of design work where you're providing a product that then sort of another class of designer, let's say like an architect or an interior designer, would then, you know, kind of look at to say, all right, well, you know, have you considered, you know, a Pavia textile wallpaper or something to that effect?
Well, Kathy and I always, you know, talked about the vocabulary of imagery that I have in my paintings, that it could be easily interpreted into other things. So, I mean, we've been talking about this 25 years, and so finally, you know, just 3 years ago or so, we decided to kind of move forward with it. And, you know, artists have done this throughout history. You know, for us, it's just, I guess, a natural evolution of what I wanted to do with my work.
Erica, you know, you guys, true to the idea of a collective, y'all consider the artists and artisans that you work with to be kind of co-owners of the project. Now, I'm just sort of curious how that actually works in principle. I mean, one word I keyed in on in sort of the research was the idea y'all are representing them, which is a, you know, kind of a concept you often hear in terms of like art galleries and things like that. How does that work?
Well, we are an L3C co-op, so we are an actual living, breathing co-op that has a nonprofit arm. And then the artisans actually run the shop. So we are actively owned and operated by the artisans in the shop.
So does that mean, like, I'm actually not that familiar with that just as a legal term of art, right? An L3C.
L3C is like an LLC, but has a nonprofit arm. There's only about 5 states that have this type of setup, and Louisiana is one of them. So we're a low profitability corporation or company, rather.
Yeah.
So we're very bootstrapped. Unlike some galleries, we're a gallery style type store. They will have either a Folklife organization that supports or sponsors them, or will have backing from museums and grants and things of that nature. We are all bootstrapped. We pay a membership, and our artisans basically pay to keep the lights on, as well as sell their items in shops. So we're kind of almost, if I had to make a comparison, like a pop-up, but okay. A pop-up that doesn't stop.
Yeah, it sounds like you're a pop-up.
We're in a brick-and-mortar space.
Yeah, it's like a pop-up that has to pay rent. I mean, so how does...
Well, a pop-up does pay rent. Every time you take part of a...
That's true.
...festival or a farmer's market, you're paying to be there. So it's the same premise.
Fair enough.
Our legal setup is we are a cooperative space owned and operated by the artisans.
Does that mean you kind of have to be a selective about who comes in? Or does somebody say, like, look, here's $100. I'm buying my spot. Now I'm a co-owner, like you would a public stock corporation, you know?
Sort of. Yeah. So you are basically buying a space. It's like you're buying a little rental, a retail space of real estate in the store. Mm-hmm. So you pay a membership fee. We have meetings. We actually vote on setup situations, but we don't vote on basically who comes in. So unlike, say, other stores that have a similar business model where there's a jury that judges who comes in or mm-hmm. who has work that is wanting to be represented in the store. We are different in that we will take new business. We will take amateur artisans. We will take people who are trying to test out a business idea. So you don't have to have this huge portfolio. I mean, obviously our end goal is to all be Francis Pavis in the end of our careers, but you can have just been someone who was making quilts in your house and, you know, established a whole collection and now need a space to sell it. So we allow new startup and artisans to come in the shop. Basically,
you know, Francis, you know, it's interesting. Like, I mean, obviously there was a point in your life where you weren't, well, I guess you were always Francis Pavi. That was always your name, unless you changed it sometime along the way. I'm not aware of that. But I mean, you know, you would have sold some paintings, I guess, at some point and found like, hey, people like what I do and I can make, I guess I'm curious, like, I mean, how would that process have actually worked for you? Maybe, I mean, you know, at what point does an artist go from somebody who says, hey, I can sell you, a friend, somebody I know, you like my work, to, you know, I can move into a space and do this commercially.
You go where the energy is. So when I was in college, I studied sculpture because I had a very energetic teacher. And after college, I couldn't do ceramics anymore. So I had a friend that did glass work and he got me a job in a glass shop. I opened a glass shop over here and then I started painting. You know, after a few false starts, I sat down one day and painted 3 paintings. And I said to myself, yeah, this is kind of interesting. And so what happened was I sold one, you know, and I bought more paint. And then I sold a few more. And then people started calling me, you know, you should do this. Or do you want to show? Why don't, you know, all the opportunities just kind of manifested. So, but within 2 years, I was making my living as a professional artist, as a painter, you know. I was doing glass work as a professional artist here. I mean, before I was a painter, but the painting kind of took over the glass work.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it seems pretty fast, right, to go, you know, from to be able to kind of consider yourself professionally. I mean, Erica, the folks that you were working with, I mean, what I guess I'd like to get a sense of like what status in their own careers are they in. Are these folks that are attempting to become professionals, or the folks that kind of this is a side hustle, or something they're just really passionate about? I mean, maybe it's all of the above. I mean, what's happening?
It's all of the above. One thing that makes us really unique and special is we're a cross-generational artisan store. So we've got youth entrepreneurs who are trying to figure out what their business may be in the future, or just learning how to have a side hustle. Then we have some artists like, you know, a Brian Benoit, who's been in the game doing artwork for many, many years. So we kind of meet people where they are. And so that's what's really awesome about it. It's an active space where we work together and collaborate together. So we are learning from one another, so that youth entrepreneur has the opportunity to be exposed to Bryant and can sit and talk one-on-one and learn and gain more experience. And then we have mid-range, we have second act seniors who have been quilting or making things their whole lives, but they didn't think they had enough, I guess, resources to make this a full-time job. So now that they're retired, they can really pursue passions, and they're in the store as well. And then we have people who always sold on Etsy or in their store online, but always wanted a brick and mortar, but didn't have a platform. So it's a hodgepodge. It's a motley crew of a bunch of very talented people. So like I said, we're trying to meet them where they are in their careers.
You know, it's interesting that you're using the word entrepreneur when you're talking about youth folks, because I mean, you know, to some extent, right, I'm thinking in my head, you know, this kind of thing with like, we're talking about crafts and stuff like that, that there's an artisanal quality to it. But entrepreneurship, you're also kind of usually thinking about, hey, I'm going to make a product that I'm going to scale up, that I'm going to try and get lots of people to buy. So, I mean, can you talk to me a little bit about who these youth entrepreneurs are, like what they're making, what they're selling in your shop?
Yes. We have a gentleman named Israel, and he's making beads. So they're beads that are sourced from various places, both locally and out of the country. And he makes beads, and he sells them usually at pop-ups. And he is about 15 years old, and his mother helps him to, you know, run the business at the pop-ups, but he's got an opportunity to showcase his beads in store, and they're very popular. People love his artwork. There's another individual in the shop also named Israel, and she is my daughter, and she sews. She's an artist. She paints and draws, but she loves to sew, which is kind of a lost art, especially amongst the younger generation. So she has taken a liking to making her own clothing and patterns. And so some of her work is showcased in the shop as well.
You're listening to Out to Lunch. I'm Christian Mader. I'm talking with Erica Fox of the Tacopah Collective and painter Francis Poppin. Francis, I'm curious. I mean, I'm really always fascinated by these silly questions that other people roll their eyes about, right? You know, what's the difference between an artist and an artisan? I think we've entered another piece of vocabulary here, was the idea of an entrepreneur. And so I guess I'm curious, like, Francis, in your life, would you have thought of yourself as an entrepreneur? Is that a word that feels familiar, that you wear in a way that's comfortable to you?
Yeah, it does feel very familiar. And I've always considered myself a professional ever since I opened the studio. I mean, I was when I graduated from college, I started doing glass work, you know, and I was a worker for somebody else. But when I opened my studio here doing glass work, I, you know, did all the professional things that you need to do, print business cards, took a loan to buy machinery, got a certificate of occupancy, you know, paid the taxes, every month. And, you know, it's, I conduct myself. I remember thinking that, I just need to conduct myself as a professional. And, you know, in doing so, that means there's a bottom line. So you have to be an entrepreneur, you know, consider yourself a business person. I don't see those terms as being, I don't see those terms fighting each other. Business person, entrepreneur, same thing pretty much for me.
Erica, it sounds like this is resonating with you.
They go hand in hand. I mean, even as a musician, a singer, and a musician, you are your own small business. You are an entrepreneur. So I think we all had that spirit of seeing the value that our creative works adds to the cultural economy of our state. So we see ourselves not just artisans making something, but seeing the bigger picture that it's providing economic opportunities for our livelihood and our families.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your entrepreneurship. I mean, Erica, you were a songwriter and you make this transition. I mean, tell me about, I don't know, well, first, how did you get from sort of doing one to the other? But I'll also be curious just to know, you know, how what your career has been like as a songwriter, right? I mean, you went out to L.A. where the, you know, the hits are made.
That's a loaded question, a good question. But I have to say, I don't feel like I transition from one to the other. I feel like it's all the same creative spirit that I'm pulling from, because I'm a creative at the end of the day. So whether I'm making jewelry or singing or writing songs, it's all sourced from the same place. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I guess, variations of that same creativity, just like Mr. Pavi can do everything from glass to painting. It's still sourced from that creative soul, if you will. Mm-hmm. I moved from Lafayette. I was born and raised here in Lafayette, and I moved to go to college at Occidental College in Los Angeles. And it was there that, although my drive was to get that record deal and perform and make music, I knew that I also had a love for learning. So I made sure to continue my education and received my degree in economics and worked a lot in finance as well. So I do have that business background as well as the creative, you know, musical background. And so my whole life has been trying to weave both of them together and utilize mm-hmm. those resources and those skill sets. My school also had a mission of multiculturalism and diversity. And of course, living in Los Angeles, you're exposed to so much culture and heritage. It was like cultural overload. And I went into a shock just realizing just the vastness of people and learning about different types of backgrounds and people's nationalities and where they came from. And I loved it. And mm-hmm. that spirit has always stayed with me. And I knew when I moved back home that I wanted to keep that same spirit alive, because we have that same magic in Louisiana as well, that culture, that deep heritage, that is a beautiful thing. And for me, going out over there and seeing a different version of it and just falling in love with it, I know that that's what people do every day when they walk into our store or when they go to Mr. Pavi's shop and see his work. It's a beauty and a deep connection that you get. And it's beautiful and it's very unique. I have to say it's very unique.
So you hooked up with the folks with No Limit Records, right? But that was based in New Orleans. I guess I'm trying to get a sense of, like, what was your music career? Obviously, it's still going. I don't mean to imply that it was. I get it. I'm a musician. I've been a touring musician for a long time. But, like, you know, so I apologize if I made it seem like you left it behind. But I'm just trying to get a sense of what that work has been like for you.
No, I didn't interpret it that way. That was actually my second record deal. I had three. I moved to Los Angeles. I was 18 when I secured my first record deal with MCA Records. I was on the label for 2 years, and then we went through executive changes. So my album was shelved. It was like grand opening, grand closing, real quick. But I learned that just because you get a record deal, that's not the end all be all, you know. So it was short lived. I had to continue to hustle. I always hustled. And that's something that I gained from just my parents. They were always entrepreneurs, and I had a family of entrepreneurs. So I always saw that hustle spirit. And so after losing the first record deal, if you will, I was still in school, still doing backing vocals for other artists, writing on other people's material. I was a performer at Universal Studios. I was working at the record company during the daytime. And I had a band on the weekend. So I never sat on my laurels. And I was able to secure a second record deal, which was with No Limit, while singing at the Laker game. At the Staples Center, which is no longer Staples Center, but so their attorney saw me there and approached me and asked me if I'd be interested in meeting with Master P. And so he set up the meeting and sang for him on the spot and pretty much the rest was history. Got a record deal with him. And I moved to Baton Rouge for about 2 years after graduating from college and recorded there for some time. But then realized that I still wanted to pursue some other things in Los Angeles. So after 2 years, I actually left the record label and went back to California to do some other things like acting and doing theater work, a lot of theater work. And that's where I got another record deal on Universal and stayed there for some time. And that's where I wrote with a lot of other artists. So I have about 30 commercial projects, whether it be albums or compilation CDs or writing on other people's albums, as well as my own.
Yeah, man, that's, you know, when I often feel like we don't get to see that veil of people who work and succeed in the music industry and just like how much work that really goes into it and all the things you have to do. I mean, it's kind of what Francis was talking about when he's saying, like, look, I opened my shop. I had to get my certificate of occupancy. I had to figure out how to pay my taxes, right? Like, there's this level of administrative work that people just don't assume that musicians and artists have to go through, but it's there, right? And I mean, Francis, I imagine even for somebody at a stage in your career, right, like you are, you're still having to do that stuff, right? I mean, it's still, you know, operating a business is still a big part of what you have to wake up every morning and do, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, and this new venture that we're involved in, Pavi Art and Design, it's a collaboration. So we have meetings weekly and talk about the mechanics of what we have to do to get this thing rolling. And we've been doing this 3 years already. So it's been quite a it's a learning process for me because there's a lot of things that I didn't know about business and actually working with people, because, you know, I did all this, you know, my solo career is just it's a solo career. You know, I deal with my gallery, which is a separate thing, or my galleries are basically pop-ups for exhibitions, you know, that's like a one-time thing. But running a business is a different thing, and working with partners is a different thing.
Does it make a difference that partner in this case is your wife? I mean, I feel like I can't avoid that question.
Well, it's great. You know, it's like, you know, we isolated for, well, it's been 18 months right now, but if I didn't love her, you know, I wouldn't be there. You know, it's like, it's been good. You know, we agree on a lot of things and really disagree.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, so I guess I'm curious, you mentioned earlier, Francis, that you really had to adapt to sort of the digitization of all this, these large scale textiles. And I mean, I think that's actually pretty interesting because I don't know that would be obvious to people that would take an extra step, right? People kind of might take a picture and say, like, wait, you can't just blow it up on a computer and do it 40 more times. And that sounds to me like it's pretty straightforward. But it sounds like your process is pretty detailed for what may end up being something that's copied many, many, many times, right?
Yeah, it is. Since I'm painting the patterns full scale, that's like 54 inches by 54 inches. And photography these days, you know, your average commercial photography that or camera that you buy, even the best ones, you know, can't photograph that kind of detail that I need to put into these textiles. So I've learned to adapt to try and get the, you know, stitch photographs together. That's a digitally stitch them together. And the lighting is a big deal. You know, they have to have even lighting across the whole plane. So and that's very, very difficult, even professional photographers. I don't know of any professional photographers that, I mean, you have to make a filter in Photoshop to even out the light. And there's all a bunch of little other tricks that I've come up with because, you know, invention, what do they say? Necessity is the mother of invention, you know?
Yeah. So Erica, I mean, at this stage, like I know obviously with the thought behind Attackapa and what you guys are trying to accomplish just even socially in terms of social impact, I mean, but even creating it as a low profit type entity, I mean, is this something that you're able to do full time for your own work, or are you still working on other projects? I mean, how does that actually end up being a full-time kind of job for you?
It is full-time because the vision that we have for the store is full-time. So my focus and passion right now has been all in on the store. So I haven't been taking any gigs or performing elsewhere. because I really want to see this store grow. As I mentioned, with the youth entrepreneurs, we have a great opportunity to help guide and lead future business and future artisans. So I take that very seriously. So I make sure that we are focused on this being successful and setting it up for success. The beauty of it too is because we're a co-op of various artisans, everyone comes with like special skill sets that contribute to the success of each other. So, you know, these artisans are interacting with one another. The space is sacred. It's all about community and building that community. And so there's a unity that's in the store. We even have a mural on the wall that says we are the dreams of many, because there's a bunch of people's passions all represented in here. And we all want to see each other succeed. So although this is my full-time venture, I feel well supported by all of the collective members that are here in shop.
Yeah. Well, obviously, passion's super important with anything. I mean, you know, we're going to think about artistry and artisanship as a form of entrepreneurship. It's something you really have to love to do it, right? The thick sort of thing that gets you out of bed in the morning. And clearly, for both of you, Francis and Erica, what you do are things you're very passionate about, and it's the reason why you're successful at it. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
My guests on Out to Lunch Acadiana have been painter Francis Pavia and Erica Fox of Patakapa Collective. We edited this conversation to fit into our time slot here on KRBS. You can hear our unedited conversation and find out more about Francis and Erica's adventures in the world of art and design by listening to the Out to Lunch Acadiana podcast. You can find and subscribe to the Out to Lunch Acadiana podcast on your podcast app and on our website. It's acadiana.com. If you want to know what we look like, you can find photos from the show on itsacadiana.com and on our social media. Those photos were taken by Astor Morgan, and you can find more of his work at astormorgan.com. This week, pandemic conditions compelled us to record Out to Lunch Acadiana by Zoom. Next week, we hope to be back at our regular lunch spot, Tula Tacos on Jefferson Street in downtown Lafayette. Tula is open for lunch and dinner and stays open late every day except Monday. Out to Lunch is a production of INO Broadcasting for itsacadiana.com and KRBS 88.7 FM. The producer of our show is Grant Morris. Our technical producer is Eric Merle. Our associate producers are Molly Richard and Jan Risher. Our researcher is Leah Erdialis. I'm Christian Mader. I'm editor of The Current, Lafayette's nonprofit info community. And for local news, commentary, and more, head over to thecurrentla.com and sign up for our newsletter. I'll see you here again next time for more business and conversation. And Out to Lunch Acadiana. Bye-bye.
Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Shorten Associates, legal recruiters in Louisiana and Texas. Mitchell Foreman wrote and performs all the music on Out to Lunch. You can hear Mitchell's music anywhere great jazz is sold or streamed, and at MitchellForeman.com.
The Zydeco Stomp is where it's at and where it is. KRVS, join me, Herman Fuselier. 3 hours of Zydeco blues and old school R&B at noon Saturdays right here on 88.7 FM and KRVS.org.
This holiday weekend, American Roots celebrates Dr. Martin Luther King in sound and spirit with music from Odetta and Johnny Cash, The Roots and Duke Ellington. Also, our conversations with Mavis Staples, writer Albert Murray, Harry Belafonte, and civil rights leader Julian Bond. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Friday afternoons at 1, following the Blues Box.
Support comes from Bernard F. Duyon, a professional law corporation focusing on personal injury, wills and estates, and business matters. The office is located at 111 Concord Street in downtown Abbeville. The phone number is 337-893-5066. 337-893-5066. Ici on parle français.
Get yourself a Tita's de Café and drop a quarter into Lalu Jukebox with me, your host, Blake Miller. This jukebox plays all the good stuff. Cajun, country, small pop, Cajun music that sounds like small pop that sounds like country, country that sounds like Cajun, Cajun that sounds...
That's Lalu Jukebox with Blake Miller, Saturday night at 6 and Sunday morning at 7, right here on KRVS.